Welcome back to Kinda Christian. It is a little dark and gloomy today, but that's no reason to be downcast because we are welcoming a very special guest, Matthias J. Barker, a fast-rising, extremely insightful, and aesthetically appealing Christian psychotherapist who is welcomed today on the program to talk about everything from marriage, spiritual disciplines, purpose, calling, and everything in between. So join us as we welcome Matthias J. Barker to the program. I love your camera setup. I mean, just for the viewers at home who don't care at all about what we're going to talk about, but just love how it looks. What are we recording on, man? It looks great.
Yeah, I got, you know, back in the day, I was one of those famous Instagram photographers that went around gallivanting in foggy mountains and lakes. And so I have all this camera gear that's just been under my bed for like 3 or 4 years that I haven't been using since those days. And so when I started doing social media stuff, I happened to know how to do good lighting and make it look all cinematic and all that stuff.
Your setup is strikingly similar to the masterclass setup. Like, I'm waiting for the classical music. Like, I'm Matthias J. Barker, and I'm your instructor for optimal mental health, right? That's not a bad idea, actually. Have you thought about
that? Strategic, I guess. It just kind of turned into a thing. I have this lamp behind me that has, like, it's a tripod lamp, and there's been this like little craze that's been happening with, which is funny with my followers, that they're like, I got the Matthias Barker lamp, and everyone like wants this lamp that's in the background, but it's just a lamp from Target. Like, it's not, it's nothing impressive. It's just a random lamp. But
can you get sponsored? Can be like the official lamp of the Matthias J. Barker show, good outfits. You know, I see you've got the green earth tones are obviously on your palette. Like, you know, what's our sponsorship, Patreon? You know, what's our deal, man? Or just the blessing of helping people, you know?
Yeah, if a lamp company came and wanted to do a sponsor deal, I'd take that in a heartbeat.
Dude, that'd be great if you're like, Matthias, today's episode on anxiety brought to you by Light Shade Universe, you know? Shine a light on your problems, right? Oh, we could have some.
Yeah, some terrible pun having to do with shining light.
I know. Be a light to the world and to your living room, right? All right, we'll get off that. So, all right, first question I have is, because in studying up on your bio and reading about this, so there are all these terms that are commingling out there in the universe. There's Christian therapist, there's psychologist, clinical psychologist, counselor, and then psychotherapist, right? Which I find to be the coolest sounding thing. And I do apologize that I really enunciated psycho on there, but obviously it just means mind. So what is a psychotherapist versus a psychologist?
Yeah, so the differentiations have to do with how much time you spent in school. So a psychologist is someone who has a PhD or a PsyD. That's another version of that, that would give you the title psychologist. A psychiatrist would be someone who went to med school and can prescribe medication.
Okay.
And then a mental health counselor or a psychotherapist, that would be someone with a master's degree. And so that's what I have.
Wow.
Got my master's in clinical mental health counseling. So mental health counselor, therapist, psychotherapist, those are all interchangeable. Just psycho beforehand just designates that I'm not like a physical therapist or I'm not like a occupational therapist. I'm a psychotherapist. And so I use psychotherapist because I think it sounds fancier, and mental health therapist is a mouthful. So I just kind of go with it.
That's great. And if I'm already dealing with some stuff, you were trying to minimize the problems. I don't need to be worried about long
I often get introduced as a psychologist, and that's a problem. They almost introduced me as a psychologist on like a famous TV show, and I was like, oh no, that would really disrupt some things, because I think I can get in trouble for that. Like people could report me for,
you could be disbarred, or you have your license revoked that you don't even have yet, right?
That'd be a bummer. Worth it.
So I could be a faux therapist, which just means someone who's actually not a therapist but pretends to be.
And then you'd have a whole like angry mob coming after you saying, hey, stop calling yourself.
You know what? That means followers. I'd love an angry mob. We're trying to cultivate an angry mob on this show. So, all right. So right out of the gate, I'd love to ask you, what is the mental health issue of our time right now, based on your experience? What are you seeing? What ailment is plaguing humanity right now that you've seen the most?
Yeah, that's a complex question. I think, There's some, maybe I'll answer it this way, because I don't know how to give like an exhaustive, comprehensive answer to that, but I think the advent of the internet and social media and how that's affecting childhood development and then how that's impacting specifically relationships is the most interesting and maybe the least understood problem that we're trying to wrap our heads around. And that's culminating in a lot of anxiety, that's culminating in a lot of depression. Like, we've seen anxiety disorders spike for young kids, for example, like higher than we have in the past 30 years. Just since 2010 to now has been kind of the highest rise in anxiety disorders for kids like 13 to 17. But strangely enough, like, you see that depression is actually going down for like adults in the past 20 years or so. You see also like maybe severe anxiety disorders going down. So that's odd. We don't really know what to make of that. But then you see like suicides going up. And so there's all this kind of conflicting data that we really don't know what to make of, as far as like, okay, what is happening in society right now? And I have theories around that because I have a layman's interest in something called media ecology, which is like the work of guys like Neil Postman, which is understanding how mediums of communication kind of affect just how people interact and affect culture. So it's almost like a kind of like anthropology, some of it's economics, some of it's psychology. It's a lot of social theorizing. And so, yeah, I think their claim that really, I mean, a lot of like Neil Postman's work was written around the television. He was writing in the 60s and he was like, hey, this is changing the way that humans are receiving information, just like the move from like the newspaper to like news on TV. He was fascinated with how that shaped how we interact with news and just kind of even public hysteria around crisis that happens just in the world. And I think his ideas copy and paste pretty relevantly over to the advent of the internet and how that's changing things. So Jonathan Haidt would be maybe the most prominent voice.
He's great. The Righteous Mind blew my mind. Yeah. It was so interesting, and I loved it. That last chapter when he talks about having conservatives and liberals fill out surveys on behalf of the other and trying to attribute their why they believe what they believe and the assumptions, and to see that both sides like had these like just really nefarious assumptions about, you know, others. And it was really interesting. He did such a great job in that book of, you know, just real, I felt like it was cool for him to celebrate too, like both sides of a dialogue, you know? I'm curious. So depression is going down, right? When they study, how do they even study that? Because my first thought is, do you poll people? Are therapists submitting like the number of cases that they get collectively? And then would people be less, is the methodology suspect? Like, if you're depressed, are you even questioning like whether I'm going to share it? Because we live in a social media world where everyone seems happy, so I'm less inclined to share that I'm depressed. Is that potentially at play?
That's a good question. So these would be, if you look on just like the World Health Organization, this is kind of the people that collect data every year, and they're just kind of looking at trends of certain things as they kind of go up and down. And up and down would be diagnosed mental disorders of major depressive disorder or similar disorders within that category of major depression. And so, I mean, it's kind of shocking. Like, I saw that and I was expecting to find the opposite. Like, it doesn't seem like that would be the case. But I think what's interesting about that data too that stuck out to me was that we're seeing more attempts of suicide, even though they're less lethal, especially with women. With men, suicidality is far more lethal. And we've seen a bit of a growing number of those. But then as far as just like kind of like lower acuity, like depression, we've seen a rise in like lower acuity, meaning less severe. So you're not completely debilitated and like you're not leaving your house, you can't get up and on those kind of things, but more like you're kind of just operating day in, day out, with a huge lack of motivation, feeling like a lot of self-criticism, a lot of guilt, a lot of frustration at yourself, and feeling that your life is just kind of purposeless and not really, you don't feel highly engaged in things. You don't feel like you have really close relationships. You're not sleeping well. Maybe you're having issues with your eating. You're eating too much. You're eating too little. Maybe you're dependent on alcohol a little too much. And so those things are still very common, and that hasn't really gone down. But like, as far as like the high acuity, depressive disorders that we've seen, I don't know, like that are reported to insurance companies, that are reported to health statistics, the high intensity stuff is going down. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know really what to make of all that, I guess. I guess a lot of people are trying to theorize right now how to synthesize like the data of some stuff's going up, some stuff's going down, but that's pretty normal. Like every new advent of like a generation and different technologies that are available in different cultures too. Like, these are all statistics from America, right?
Yeah.
So we're not talking worldwide. These are US statistics. It's like, how do you make sense of that? What's the cause? And I think proving causation is really tricky because everything is like in this flow of lots of different variables that are affecting things. So you could say, oh, it's just the internet, but But maybe not. Maybe it's not the internet. Maybe it's also just like our agriculture and the way that we're eating is totally different. Like, especially in America, like we're eating tons of preservatives and fast food. And maybe that's having a huge, you know, effect. Like, undoubtedly that's having an effect. And, you know, so I think like in Jonathan Haidt, I referenced him in The Coddling of the American Mind. He really talks, he presents, I think, a really compelling theory for how specifically 2010 was when broadband internet was really widely available. And we've studied quite, not conclusively, because there's always margin for error here, but like with young people, 13 to 17, it's had a very, very negative effect. The more that they are connected to the internet, the earlier in age that they have access to things like social media, the more reported anxiety disorders, in women in particular, anxiety disorders, eating disorders, depressive disorders, not so much in men, I think, and he has reasons why he thinks that, but it's fascinating. So as far as like the larger ailment, what's plaguing us in society, I guess I don't know. I guess there's a lot of things to consider.
Well, no, I've been curious about this. You know, as we sort of trend towards the AI discussions and, you know, technology continues, you know, for all the bad news out there, right, there's a movement of there's a thought movement that says that technology is accelerating so quickly that we'll be able to optimize and become so efficient that you might actually be able to provide for people at a basic sustenance level, but there's going to be a lot of people, you know, who don't have anything to do. Like, what if we achieved this sort of like nirvana of technology where robots do everything? Like, how do we find meaning? And I forget who the speaker I saw, but he said his point was, he said the biggest thing that keeps him up at night is, what are we going to do and how are we going to find purpose if we don't have jobs and basically vocations to do if robots eventually did take over, you know, and optimize so much of it. And I thought, that's interesting. So when you talk about a lot about that with your videos, with purpose, et cetera. So especially in a quarantine and times when so many things are shut down, how do you help people think through finding purpose and meaning when there's so much uncertainty swirling around right now?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's three big things that I really focus on. So one would be that you feel like you have well-connected and meaningful relationships with people around you, where you feel like you're an essential piece of a community. Like that's an essential part, I think, of having a flourishing life and finding purpose and meaning. It's like, well, what's the purpose? The purpose can't just be this indwelled sense of who you are and being happy, who you are in a tube, just kind of by yourself in a vacuum. There's an interconnectedness, and much of our depression, much of the crisis that plagues us so intensely is interpersonal. It's how suffering interacts within our social connections. It's abuse. It's trauma with other people. It's our deepest wounds are wounds that happened in community. And so our way of healing, our way of kind of rising to a place of purposefulness and well-roundedness just as a human being also happens within community. And so I focus a lot on just like a really basic question, like, tell me about your friends. Do you like your friends? Like, are your friends people that you respect? Do you feel like you can depend on them? Do you feel like you want to be like them? Like, and those are really sharp questions, because it reveals right away, like, oh no, like maybe I have buddies that I go get a drink with. I have buddies that I kind of connect with, but not really. And, or I don't have anybody, like I'm just alone, or I have these friends online. And then that really kind of, when we start to put together this web of here's how to maybe improve the social connections, here's how to feel more embedded within a community of people that you love and respect that are all moving towards the same direction. Purposefulness really almost arises out of that. So that's one dynamic. Another thing that I focus on is feeling like there's just internal consistency with the actions that you're exhibiting and the beliefs that you say you believe. So a lot of the purposelessness, a lot of the feeling kind of aimless can also be derived from just feeling incredible amounts of guilt and self-criticism and having a lack of confidence that you can do anything that you would respect. And that's 6 months of therapy right there. It's like having conversations about what are your standards for yourself? What are your standards for life? What does it look like to be someone that contributes positively to the world? And how do you see you in reference to that standard? And then how are you motivating yourself to get to that standard? Are you berating yourself with self-criticism? Are you highlighting all your insufficiencies with this ruthless dictator-like intensity? Or do you have compassion for yourself? Do you see yourself in process, or do you see yourself as like a number on a scale?
Yeah.
And so that's another dynamic, is we're looking at how you're embedded in community. We're looking at just like kind of your own internal schema or way that you conceptualize yourself, and the guilt and self-criticism or the anxiety that swims inside just your own psyche. Those are two things that I think I focus on a lot. I'm trying to think of a third one, just because I always like putting things in threes, but yeah. there's probably another one I could talk about. But yeah, let's start with those two.
So, and I'm going to ask to paint with a broad brush here, but when people come to you, or and just humans in general, they look at, it's a common phrase, we're all broken, right? We all have our, and I don't know if this would be the correct use of the term, but our neuroses, and we all have things that we do that bug us, right? We have, you know, mental patterns, thought processes, like everyone has their thing that they do that they're like, why do I do that? And they might even know that they do it, right? Is it, painting with this broad brush, do most of the negative things we have about humans, whether it's, you know, acting out, anger, you know, lying, anything that we'd consider negative behavioral patterns, are those typically rooted in trauma or wounding that happened? Like, do we learn to wound from being wounded? Is that what happens? Like, when we get down to human imperfection, where does that really come from? Because we all take for granted everyone's broken, but like, you know, is it in most cases you can trace a negative pattern in your life to something that adversely affected you, or do they just sometimes just like, you know, they just happen because you're just who you are? You know, how does that, may be a convoluted way of asking that.
That's a great question. I think through that, I mean, I'm in a sense asking that question every time I'm doing like a first like assessment with somebody that comes into my office that's seeking therapy. And so I'm trying to find out what's the root cause, right? So it's not just that if we resolved the root cause, everything would go away, because oftentimes the ways that we cope with the root cause create problems of their own. So it's not just a matter of, all right, let's just get down to the heart of it. And then if we can fix that, then everything else will click into place. Like, that would be great. That sometimes it feels that way. Like, I think for a lot of people, salvation feels that way. Like, they come into a relationship with Jesus and then they don't even desire to smoke anymore. They don't even desire to drink anymore. And they get embedded within a community at church, and then they just feel completely renewed and refreshed, and they're happy. And it just feels like one thing happened and then their life just got better. And that's great. There's even theologies around that, like theologies of deliverance, that just kind of refresh you all in one go. And that's just,
okay.
That's,
well, you brought it up. So you brought up Jesus, which I guess is good considering this podcast called Kind of Christian. At some point we were going to get to this. Right. Oh man, I have so many questions for you. And of course, all these questions asking for a friend, right?
Let me finish that thought real quick though, because that'll give you a little context for your next question. Is I'm thinking not just about maybe the internal root of trauma, which absolutely can happen, but I'm also thinking about development. So what lessons did you learn from your parents about how to interact with yourself, how to interact with the world? What did you learn about you? What did you learn about the world from your parents? I'm also thinking even in utero, just like, what were the experiences that you had just even biologically, like coming into this world? Like, I work with people who have like alcohol fetal syndrome because their mother drank while they were pregnant with them. And wow. That affects things like, they're way more likely to have things like ADHD, way more likely to have like behavior problems in school. There's all sorts of different symptoms that can accompany just very biological traumas that happen even in the womb. And so it's a complex, you know, amalgam of biology and even how your DNA is encoded from the trauma that your grandparents, up to your grandparents, you experienced. And a lot of us don't know how to put our finger on that, but for many of us in America, like, our grandparents suffered through the Great Depression or went to war, like in World War II or Vietnam. And that has actually been shown to change the encoding of how the DNA replicated. And we've seen that, especially in rat studies, all the way up to the third generation, when a grandparent rat experiences trauma, that trauma, that reactiveness, maybe is another way to say that, is found to work itself out in behavior of the grandkids. And so there's all sorts of things. There's the trauma you experienced. There's the trauma your grandparents might have experienced. There's the biological components of just how your body was formed and put together. There's getting bullied at school. And there's what your parents taught you about what it meant to be a man or a woman. Or, you know, it's complex. And then that's not even like society and all the pressures of media. So I think sin affects society and biology and the person in every facet and in every dimension. And so it can't usually be just sourced back to just one thing. although one thing can be cataclysmic for sure, it's an amalgam of things. So sorry, go ahead.
No, you brought up so many things I want to ask, and I knew we were going to run into this because I find your work so interesting. All right, so let's start integrating faith into this. What are some things top of mind that, you know, you might have heard in the religious faith community? You know, you mentioned, you know, trauma, like the, you know, the sins of the father carried on, et cetera. What are some things that maybe have been around and existent in faith as it pertains to people, and but now science is actually starting to confirm. Like, you just, that's a great one where you're like, oh yeah, trauma, it's now, I had heard that, I'm like, is that really true? And it's like, oh yeah, now they're saying that trauma is actually genetically passed on, at some, it's stored in some way. What are some things that faith has been saying for years and now science is sort of confirming when it comes to mental health and your work?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that comes to mind for me is just the mindfulness practices that have kind of been vogue recently, and meditation and focusing on your breath. Like, that's been in the Christian contemplation traditions forever. Like the monastics, it was funny, I was reading a book by Martin Laird, who's a scholar on monastics and in Christian contemplation. I forget which school he's at, but he's kind of a major voice. Into the Silent Land was a book that he wrote. I got that recommended from Jean-Marc Comer on his Instagram. He talked about that. And I was reading that book, and I just felt like, holy crap, I'm reading Steve Hayes and acceptance and commitment therapy. Like, this is like almost bar for bar, like mindfulness. And wow, how in the world is it? It almost felt like plagiarism. I was mad. I was like, this is, why, how did I not know of this before? And even in reading people like Dallas Willard or people that have maybe paid attention to the monastic traditions, and by monastic, for people listening, we're talking kind of like early Christianity, like around 300-400 AD and into kind of like right before the Middle Ages, kind of just this period of people that kind of went out into the wilderness and like tried to connect with God in silence and in solitude. And some of them came back and brought their insights and then reintegrated back in the world. Some of them just wandered out into the wilderness and stayed there. But everyone's reflecting on what it means to connect with the divine, and doing that specifically through the practice of having present awareness and noticing the chaos of the thoughts that, you know, kind of arise when you just sit quietly by yourself, like all these anxieties and all the things you have to do, all the ways you need to fix yourself just emerge from almost within you. And that's a pretty normal experience. But the practice of almost not quite detaching from it, but noticing those things and then bringing attention back to the presence of God, bringing attention back to the promises of God. And like an analogy that Martin Laird uses that is almost like exactly an analogy that is used often in acceptance and commitment therapy, which I just thought was funny, but he uses this analogy of like we're a mountain and there's weather happening on the mountain, and the weather is our emotions and our thoughts, and the lightning is kind of striking around us. But the part of Christian contemplation and prayerful contemplation and silence and solitude is realizing we are not the weather.
Mm.
These thoughts and these emotions that plague us and that are stressing us out and that are relentlessly trying to demand our attention and our action. We are something more than that. We are something more rooted and more concrete than that. We are the branches and he is the vine. We are in and of God. And there's a groundedness that gives you, so that when you are interacting with the weather, that you can make wise decisions and you can pick which thoughts and which feelings to associate with and which ones to act on and which ones are like, oh, well, okay, that's an interesting thought, but that's not really something that aligns with what I believe or how I want to act. And because the reality is that not every thought that pops in our head is us. Like, it's echoes from a critical parent. It's echoes from a bully or a teacher. We have thoughts from media and people who are unkind to us, that girlfriend or boyfriend that dumped us for not being good enough. Like, we have all these things that echo through our brains. Instead of really fusing to those thoughts and just kind of treating everything as literally true and of the deepest essence of who I am, you know, the studies of within Christian contemplation, we're talking people like John of the Cross or Ignatius, like these men that have carved the way of saying, hey, we are of the kingdom of God and we are children within the kingdom of God, and we are renewed and refreshed and given godly and heavenly bodies one day, but we are regenerated and living a new life today. And that includes this ability to maybe distance ourselves from all of the concerns of the world, you know, in Christian language, and to be able to associate wisely and thoughtfully in the world, but bringing like God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, so to speak. I hope that's not too abstract.
No, so practically speaking, I'm curious. So practically speaking, right, this is, and I, this is, again, asking for a friend here. We'll call him Brian. I call it monkey brain, right, where just all of a sudden you sit down and you're like, I mean, literally you start focusing on a task and 9 other things that you have to do pops up in your mind, or whether you're sitting there trying to just meditate or pray or whatever. You know, just have, I got you every morning. Brian tries to have coffee in the morning and just sit and just think. And it's amazing the number of tasks that pop up. And I got to do this, got to do this. And I've often wondered if that's a human reaction to wanting to put off or escape something, what they're doing is just thinking about other stuff. But I know that that's also gone up. It seems like that's gone up in society with all this information and our brains being trained to react to bite-sized bits and our attention spans going down. Just practically speaking, since you brought it up, how do you combat that? How do you combat the mind going like all of firing all over the place?
Yeah. Well, you know, and this would be informed by acceptance and commitment therapy, but I think has really like close parallels to everything I've been reading in Christian contemplation, would be the idea that it's not even that we're trying to kind of discard or control or exert kind of force over these thoughts. These thoughts are occurring, but we just notice that we're something other than the thoughts, and that we get to choose which thoughts to act on and which ones not to. And it's not really an exercise in demanding that only certain thoughts enter our mind and only thoughts can, you know, even torment us. It's part of being human, part of just being on this planet, is being burdened by everything that feels chaotic and out of order. That's the human experience. And so having an expectation that I can descend to some sort of enlightenment some sort of spiritual maturity, that those things don't burden me, like, isn't realistic. Like, Jesus was burdened by the cross. He asked, like, God, like, if there's any other way that we can do this, like, let's do that instead, but your will, not my will. And that's a great model of just experiencing, not avoiding, not pretending like they're not there, not even getting frustrated with yourself for the thought being there, but God, this is how I'm feeling. This is my thought, but I'm submitted to your will. And I see that in Paul too. Paul was plagued with all sorts of anxieties and frustrations and the thorn in his side, but also just even in the book of Acts, like all the things that came his way that he didn't expect and that caused him psychological distress. But he was grounded in who God is. And I think that there's a wisdom there. I just, even in Job, Job was a righteous man, but he felt the full gravity of all the suffering that he was enduring. He got bad advice from his friends. He got cynical. He got frustrated. But then when he met with God, he grounded himself in who God is. And I think it would be a pretty hard sell and a hard thing to pitch someone, to be like, if you just meditated enough, if you just prayed enough, then you wouldn't feel psychologically distressed. I don't see any hope in that either. It's when you encounter distress, when you encounter the storm, you're grounded, you're rooted in the presence of God, who is the master of the storm, and he'll guide you.
So in the Christian tradition, there's a concept of the renewal of the mind, and there's also the Holy Spirit dynamic, which according to Christian tradition, followers of Christ who accept him are imbued with this Holy Spirit who actually dwells in their mind or somewhere within their greater metaphysical being, right? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned multiple voices in your head, right? There's dark voices, potentially, if you believe that spiritual paradigm. Dark voices, there's Holy Spirit, there's just your natural clutter of the mind saying, hey, here's, you know, laundry we got to do or whatever, right? So it seems like a pretty crowded house in there.
Yeah.
What has, I think something I've personally always struggled with is, on one hand, you mentioned Paul, Jesus, etc. All the heroes of Christian faith comment and have dark nights of the soul. So I don't see anything in scripture that says, you know, you pray and everything just goes great. Everyone's wrestling and at some point going, where are you, God? Right. On the other hand, there's all this language promising, like, God says, I'm near the brokenhearted, right? I'll give you the peace that surpasses all understanding. I'll never leave you, never forsake you. There's a be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Yeah. So what actually leads to, in your opinion, what does the renewal of the mind process look like? As you mentioned earlier, praying, and sometimes people just get over it. But do you think the fact that it generally takes a long time to renew people's minds, that's consistent with the Christian tradition, that it takes a long time?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone thinks that. I mean, even John Wesley in his book, Christian Perfection, like, he still thinks it takes a long time. You know, it's I think everyone is kind of on this path of trying to, and maybe this would be a good thing to specify. Like, I don't think the arrival, so to speak, is not being disturbed by pain or not experiencing pain or not experiencing distress. I think it's rather that, like, there's this line that I like from Gregory the Great, he wrote a book on pastoral care. Is that Gregory the Great or the other Gregory? I don't remember. One of the Gregs.
I'm a little rusty on my Gregories right now.
One of those Gregs. He wrote a book on pastoral care, and something that he said was, for someone to be, you know, filled with the Spirit and ready for pastoral ministry, they ought to be stout in fasting. And there's this idea of, it's not even that the pain doesn't affect them, that they're not in pain. It's that they stand stout in the face of it. And that has been a model for me, like, when I think of just my own psychological distress, because I don't know, I'm going through things all the time too. And it's, as a counselor, like, you're always attending to everyone else's pain while trying to hold your own complexities in life. And I'm feeling like we have our daughter is on the way in March. And
oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my wife's expecting. And there was just a long time where she was really just scared because baby wasn't flipping over. And if you know anything about just like the process of birth, is that the baby needs to be head down. And that's how, you know, the baby should go through the birth canal in a way that's really, you know, maybe mitigates the likelihood of complications. But if you have a breech baby or the baby is feet down, then that creates a lot of complications, that potentially baby could get stuck and then you need a C-section or, you know, what have you. And so it's not the end of the world, but it was really scary. We were just kind of really hoping and praying the baby would flip over. And there was just moments where, like, my wife and I were just really contending and praying with the Lord, like, gosh, like, God, I think maybe just the fear of having a young life in your hands maybe sat on me for the first time. It just, in that small instance, it was the first fork in the road where I'm like, oh, something could go wrong with my child that I don't even know yet, but I love so much. And I've just felt the weight of that and felt highly anxious. And so did my wife, and just praying. And I think just the fear of, oh, life is fragile and she could, like, I don't know, it again, like, this might be an overreaction to if you're familiar with the birth process, like, breech births happen all the time and people are okay. Like, but I don't know, like, it was just our first confrontation with maybe just the mortality idea of this young one. And for whatever reason, like, that just really disturbed me for a while. And it's not that pain doesn't affect me, or that I can immediately have these kind of Christian isms that make it go away, or it's just that I contend with the pain head on. I don't avoid it, and I'm not crumbled by it, but I can stand stout in the face of it. And I can maybe enter into it courageously, is another way of saying that. And feel the full distress in a similar way that Jesus felt the full distress of what the cross meant. He was sweating blood. Like, he wasn't trying to shove away any of the emotions. He wasn't trying to cheer himself up. He wasn't even trying to encourage himself. He just was feeling it, but he submitted to the Lord. And then when he was even on trial, he stood in silence. He stood stout, is another way to say that, like, in the face of all of it. And he attended to things that mattered to him in the pain. Like, he attended to his mother. He made sure that someone was taking care of his mom. He encouraged the man on the cross next to him and said, you're going to be with me in paradise. Like, he was present. And that's something I think that pain really tries to push us to, is pain tries to push us to all the ways that we can fix what's coming, that we don't know what's coming. It tries to criticize ourselves that we need to be acting in different ways to mitigate the pain. But I think maybe a Christian model for standing stout in the presence of pain is being fully aware and fully present, both with the bad and the good, and knowing that you're not going to be crumbled by it, but you can stand resilient and experience everything that's coming your way. But standing in trust of the presence of God with you. Wow. So I don't know. That's my thought on that.
You obviously have a knack and a passion for, I love this, early church fathers and thinkers. And what are some spiritual disciplines that have been discussed for centuries that maybe have been neglected at our own to our own detriment that are now you're seeing? And obviously you mentioned John Mark Comer, and in his book, Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, talks about Sabbath and resting and how vital that is. And it seems like all along there's been this prescription for dealing with much of what ails us today. But what are some of the spiritual disciplines you have found to just yield the most fruit?
Well, yeah, I'm a big fan of John Mark Comer. His book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, is a great one.
You're welcome, John Mark, by the way. You're welcome for that plug. All right.
Huh?
I say you're welcome, John Mark.
he's maybe one of my favorite teachers in America right now. I really trust and admire that guy. He in a lot of ways, I think he really was one of the main people that helped me kind of rediscover some of these disciplines, along with Dallas Willard. So Dallas Willard has a book called The Spirit of the Disciplines that really is a great survey over the tools that have been in the toolbox in the Christian church, you know, for the whole ride, so to speak. and a lot of them are undervalued in the current American church and for many reasons. And I think John Mark is another current voice trying to advocate for some of those.
So give me a couple. Richard, what are your favorite ones? What are some ones you love that have just yielded enormous fruit?
I practice Sabbath. So I take a day a week where I get away from my phone and starting in the evening and then ending in the evening the next day. So the end of my week is a Monday. So I work Tuesday through Saturday. Sunday. Sorry. I start in the evening and we cut electricity as much as, you know, that makes sense. And so we just kind of walk by candlelight and
pray
and we listen to worship music and we stretch. That's a tradition that we've started doing is like, let's just take that night to just stretch. And then we have like a long conversation over a really good bottle of wine. I'll kind of splurge and get something real nice and we'll have a good meal that was intentionally made. And that's just a time I think in the week for my wife and I to catch up about meaningful things. So beyond just like, oh, how was your week? How was your day? It's like, I think this last Sabbath, like we had a long conversation just on friendship and what friendships are important to us, what we think is necessary in friendships, moving into being parents, like how do you think our friendships are going to change? And so that was really meaningful. Next day is usually filled with spending time with family. So my parents live in town, so we'll go spend time with my parents or some friends. And it's very social. Like we're both pretty social people. So
that's great.
Again, trying to get away from our phones. I spend the morning often reading, and I read theology on Sabbath. Like I'm always reading psychological journals and psychology books, but on Sabbath, just a personal thing I want to do is, okay, I'm reading theology that day. I'm reading church fathers. I'm reading John Wesley. I'm reading Martin Laird. I'm reading John Mark. I'm trying to fill myself with thoughts of God. And then I pray for a long time. I go on a long walk. And then kind of moving into the evening, we kind of wake back up and I don't know, we'll go out to eat or something. I don't know. We'll kind of go back to normal life, but that has been such a refreshing practice. I think that's led to a lot of sustainability for me is just this ability to work really, really hard all week, knowing that there's going to be this crash, but not a burn, but a crash and renewal. And I think my body even feels the rhythm of it. It's like I'm getting to the end of my work week and I'm feeling so like depleted, but then just those moments of getting to read and to talk to my wife and to stretch and even just the lighting of having dim lighting and it's all speaks to the soul in a really powerful way. And so I don't know, like I said, I'm a big fan of John Wesley. He thought that it was incumbent upon Christians to practice the Sabbath. Like it was theologically required. And I think he makes a good case for that. I'm not a theologian, so I'm not going to make like decisions one way or the other, but I think that the Sabbath was certainly established before the Jews got hold of it. It was established in creation. And I think that the Jews had an expression of that, that God maybe handcrafted for them and worked with them. And I think Americans have an expression of Sabbath that they need too. And it might look different. It might look different than the Hebrew Sabbath. It might not include all of the cultural icons, but it's going to, I think we're kind of discovering it as we go and God will reveal that to the church in his time. And it's like, okay, what does it look like for an American in 2021 to take a day off and not just a day off from like just to entertain ourselves and to go shopping and to watch Netflix and to, mm-hmm. you know, binge a TV show, but to actually refresh ourselves and remind ourselves that we're not a machine that produces things. We're human. And so that is maybe the most close to my heart practice that I've incorporated. That's a tall order. Whenever I pitch it to someone, almost, you know, nobody likes the idea. When I first talk about it, like, I don't have time. I would get bored. That feels like a waste of time. But then the people I can talk into actually giving it a shot, even if it's just for an afternoon, it's self-evident.
Yeah.
It reminds you of something human in you.
Totally. Well, you did mention they get a bottle of wine. That's, you know, one of the perks to start. Yeah.
Usually the sell. If I can get a bottle of wine that they'll like, they'll usually come.
Yes. Start off there. I want to come back to a minute to the more spiritual side of the voices, that we interact with. So how would you go about helping people discern the different voices in their head, and how do you go about recognizing, you know, because adopting a spiritual paradigm, there's God's voice, right? Which is, you know, oftentimes is discussed as, you know, presenting a either a verse or a thought that seems outside your normal thinking, and it's an impression, and that's obviously a whole nother discussion. But and then there's the enemy and the dark side, as we'll call it, which tends to be accusatory, etc. And then there's also self-criticism, right? And there's our own natural stuff. So how do you go about sorting through all those and trying to discern, because there's a lot going on in there.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think a lot of the self-critical voices feel like the water that we're swimming in, so they're hard to identify on our own. Mm-hmm. We do that in community, I think, is being able to kind of talk about the things that we've come to believe about ourselves and which of those are healthy and which of those are informed by past traumas or people in our life that weren't looking out for our best. And so that's a common thing I'll do in my clinical practice with people outside of trying to distinguish the word of God, but just on a more broad level of like, okay, which voices in my head should I prioritize and which ones should I not be suspicious of, but just be mindful of, maybe is one way to say it. And so that's done in community. And that comes from having deep and rich friendships with people that know you well, and then also are aligned with your values and can remind you of what.
You're saying you share those thoughts with people and they can say, hey, no, that is not, like, this is the truth.
Yeah.
That is not. So just candidly, since obviously as a practicing Christian, do you believe that, you know, whatever iteration of Satan and his, you know, fallen angels are around and active, that they play an active role in trying to attack mental health and keep people from thriving?
Yeah. So I believe that.
So how do you, is there a way that you would say that seems like, because it would seem like from a strategic standpoint, if I was a, you know, malevolent, you know, evil being, I would try and hide under mental, you know, or accusation, just stuff that's the normal self-critical stuff, right? Is there a way that you would say, yeah, you know, this is where it kind of crosses the line to, I might actually tell a client, yeah, you know, I think that's actually more spiritual in nature than just standard, you know, human self-doubt?
That's a good question. I think though that, I don't know, and this is all conjecture. Like I don't know.
We get
these are just my opinions. Like, but my guess is that, like in reading Screwtape Letters, I kind of came to a new imagination for what it looks like for demonic forces and how they try to impact people. And my guess is that there's the most efficacious strategies would be to, inflict like the wrong ideas or unefficacious ideas or selfish ideas, whatever, like sinful ideas, but within contexts of relationships with other people. And so it's trying to lean and obscure and manipulate the will, but within sequence of processes that are happening within community and with other people too. And so it's maybe you're like trying to wrestle with the idea of like, should I look at porn tonight? Should I not? And then you're trying to like really like exercise like this willpower in the mind. And then maybe Satan's trying to tempt you and really trying to talk you into it. Like maybe, like, I'm not going to say that it doesn't happen, but I don't think that's the primary battleground for demonic temptation is just trying to like obfuscate your willpower. I think that the primary ground is trying to get you to believe things that look and seem like the truth, but that lead to destruction. And specifically, and again, this is all conjecture. This is just totally, my opinions, but I think to lead you into willful dishonesty in small ways that in aggregate and over time create catastrophes and maybe undermine what God's trying to do in your life and what God's trying to do in you. And so I think that's when we say the father of lies, like, I think there's a real interplay between the truth and acting honestly and acting in integrity and then acting in ways that no one can know because your intentions are only visible by you. But in a way that you know in your own heart is dishonest, you know in your own heart is just trying to push your own agenda in a way that the other person can't fully consent to. When you're in an argument with somebody, when you're criticizing your spouse, when you're being short-tempered with your kid, that you can excuse yourself and then no one can tell you otherwise because no one knows your intentions. But in your own heart, you know. Like, you know that you're not just trying to win an argument, you're trying to stomp on them. Yeah. Like, you know that you're not just trying to, well, you know, it's true, but you know you're exaggerating, or you know that you're that's maybe the battleground that I see is most ripe for manipulation by dark forces. So
would you say as the more mature someone becomes in faith that it's not just the, you know, obviously, hopefully, there has to be some sort of outward transformation, I would argue, right? Based on what we read in scripture, it would seem to be, has to be some outward transformation, but I've heard it said that the actual metric is the time to repentance and the recognition that what you've said or done and knowing the true meaning, right? Because that is the, ostensibly that's the role of the Holy Spirit is to convict and say like, oh, like I knew what I did right there, right? And to come back and take a look. And hopefully those events become less and less and we're, you know, continually in process as we like to say, right?
Yeah, I love that. I think humility is absolutely going to be a fruit of the Spirit in that. I also try to hold intention that often God can develop things in us that really grow into spiritual fruit and maturity, but there's also decisions that we make that also grow in sin and those things can somewhat grow at the same time. Like, for example, that we can enjoy the work of, I don't know, many of the theologians that were at work in early America, like Jonathan Edwards. Like, he has really helpful things to say about Christian theology, but he also owned slaves. And wow. It's like, what do we make of that? Do we toss the dude out completely? And a lot of people would argue yes. And John Piper has gotten a lot of heat for liking that guy so much, like, because he was in sin. And that was an evil thing to do.
I never knew that about Jonathan Edwards. Wow. Sinners in the hands of an angry God. And the whole time he had slaves?
Yeah, I believe I'm right on that. Or he... I don't want to like accuse him of things he didn't do. Yeah, he owned slaves. I'm trying to remember. There was a theologian that also had a child with a slave, and even though he was married, and
I'll tell you what. Afterwards, we'll go research afterwards.
Yeah, go research that. Don't put that on Jonathan Edwards. Yeah.
No. If we're totally wrong, we'll just cut this out. So
yeah.
If we're totally wrong, I'm gonna
Google it on my phone just because I don't want to, like, there's some Calvinists listening right now that just had their world shook.
Yeah, but they knew this was supposed to happen. So as if they had a choice, you know?
Yeah. And that doesn't even have to be necessary. Yep. Edwards owned several black slaves.
Wow.
Yep. Including young boys who were kidnapped. Yep.
That is just, God. How do you separate, like, how you, that's the same for me with Thomas Jefferson, the man who writes the Declaration of Independence, right? That all men are created equal, you know, and then had slaves and just, it's like, how do you look at yourself in the mirror and do that?
And I think that the Christian tradition has an interesting answer to that. And that's that even men who do lots of good in the world we're still sinful. And we still can make awful, awful decisions. And that's like in the Bible too, like Christianity's not trying to hide that. Like David had tons of wives and was awful to his wives and killed tons of people. killed this woman's husband and then raped her, like, as king. And this is
Uriah the Hittite. Yeah, put him to the front of the lions, got him murdered. And it's like, it's insane.
And we sing all his songs every Sunday in church, the Psalms. We treat them as inspired scripture, and we should. But like, there's this strange, like, on one hand, people can do incredibly good and enriching things and even have a relationship with God that isn't founded on their own righteousness, but founded on God's righteousness. And they can even draw close in relationship with God while still being incredible sinners and doing things that are just evil and awful, or being capable of those things at least. And that's like this seeming paradox that really disrupts people. Wow. And I think that it's really easy to look into the past and be like, that was just really awful, but it's not obvious in our own hearts how we're doing that as well.
Man.
And that there's times that we're communing with God, but then we're also harboring all of this sin and all of this, all these behaviors that we know are making the world a worse place.
Yeah.
And it's easy to point at Jonathan Edwards, of course, like, cause that's, you know, obviously evil what he did. And that makes me never want to read him. But like, I also have sins in my own heart that people are going to look at that are going to be like, okay, can Matthias be capable of all these helpful and nice things and still, you know, still be capable of all these evil things? I don't know. I could go on that for a long time, but what are your thoughts around that?
Well, here's the thing. As I knew was going to happen, we're going to run short on time here, and I cannot not ask you as a teaser, because we're just going to have you back. We're just going to have to have you back, because I can't not ask you a question or two about relationships and marriage in particular.
Okay,
so you've got some great stuff on there. Okay. A little bit of a lightning round here, but
hit me.
Do you think that, do you subscribe to that there is God's intended for people, or that there's a large swath of people you're compatible with and you should and choose that, you know, with the direction of God?
I have a hard time answering that question without getting into God's middle knowledge and his foreknowledge.
I know it opens up, and it's just some people are like, you know what, like, God just like, he picked this person for me and it was ordained, right? And other people are like, no, I'm compatible with a lot of people.
I think at the very least, I don't think you have access to that kind of special revelation.
Yeah.
And I don't think, listen, my grandpa swears that God told him in a prayer that his wife was the one, and he didn't even like her, but he married her runaway because he thought God told her.
Whoa.
And I'm only here today because of
his obedience.
So, I mean, I'm happy he acted on that, I guess.
Yeah.
I like my genes.
Marriage? Did they have a good marriage and made it work?
Yeah, it was my great grandpa. Yeah, they were married for a long time. So it's strange.
Okay. Now, was that your experience?
Say again.
Was that your experience? Did God tell you in a prayer to marry your wife?
No, and I never advise it.
Yeah.
Because I think that my guess is that God wants you to have the personal ownership in the decision that you make to marry somebody, because you're going to need to lean on that when things get hard. Is that you made a decision and it's your responsibility to follow through with not just a commitment, but to follow through and affectionately loving and pressing into care for that other person. Not just as like this cold rule that, well, you said you would, so you have to, but that personal ownership of, I chose you for good times, for hard times. I chose you whether we're understanding each other and our communication's great or we're going through a rough patch. And I think it would complicate your relationship with God pretty intensely if you got into a marriage because God told you, and then the marriage is really hard, and then you would blame God because he did this to you. I think that's just a whole mind game that doesn't work. So if you're listening and you think that you're going to marry somebody just because God told you, cut it out. This is a sign. I'm just joking. I once did that to somebody. This is a funny story, but I had someone approach me and was like, hey, yeah, God told me I'm going to marry this person and that I should wait until, you know, to date or anything until this person's available. And I was like, well, what's making this person unavailable? It's like, well, they're married, but God told me they're going to get divorced and then I'm supposed to marry them. I'm like, ah, okay. Nope. Wrong. And
yeah, why don't you step into my office for a minute? Let's talk this out a little bit. Wow.
Yeah, I'm like, all right, tell me about your childhood. Like, we need to dig into some stuff.
Sorry, I bet
that sounds super judgmental. But I just don't want people, it's often a game that ends in a lot of people suffering. That's maybe my point.
Do you in your practice, do you do pre-engagement counseling or premarital counseling?
Mm-hmm, I do a lot of that.
What would you say for those who are about to take the plunge, et cetera, you know, either about to get engaged or, you know, in premarital? What are just some things that are just like, these are the absolute things you have to look for and really we're trying to suss out in that process?
Yeah. Okay. Well, three things.
Always three.
One, my recommendation would, here's the biggest conflicts I see with couples. I do tons of marriage counseling. So the biggest conversations, the things that really disrupt close relationship, are arguments over things like finances. You'd be surprised, but tidiness and just like general, living and like decisions on should we buy a house? Should we do a project? Stuff like that. Like, things like work and future dreams. And like, if someone wants to move for work, someone wants to do a PhD, someone wants to just stay and kind of work an easy life, retire early versus someone who wants to work a whole bunch. Some other arguments are questions around sexuality and sexual connection. So there's a few things I think you could just put in your tool belt that maybe feel a little bit irrelevant now, but when life circumstances present them to you, you'll have something to go off of. And so I'd say, do Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University. Do it. I've so many couples coming in that cannot make like reasonably negotiated decisions over money. And it's just a silly reason to have your marriage fall apart, that because you can't decide what to spend and what not to spend. So just go do it. And even if you think, oh, we're fine, we're totally aligned, just do it anyway. Like, wow. Go learn about CDs and bank accounts and mutual funds and homeowners insurance and just get that under your belt. And so that would be helpful. Just on a practice.
So they just must miss that in the dating process. We'll have to do this more on another episode, but there's the whole courtship, I kiss dating goodbye. There's the fact that dating doesn't even exist in a Middle Eastern standpoint, right? It's, you know, you're like a kid and then one day you're like a grown person, and due to land and economic arrangements, the village is, you know, going to, you know, that's your marriage, right? Half the world. I watched that show on Netflix, Indian Matchmaking.
I haven't seen it, but I know it.
It's fascinating. And people just get married through a matchmaker and they do compatibility and they have these beautiful, long lasting marriages. And I thought, man, like, there's something to be said for that. And I'm curious, you know, it's funny. And in the show, they delineate the difference between an arranged marriage and a love marriage.
Yeah.
And I thought that's so interesting. What's Matthias's sort of dating advice when people are dating, you know, to look for? And obviously, it seems Chris Rock always said, I think it was Chris Rock, he said that when you're dating, the problem is you're dating each other's PR reps or agents. So you're getting the best side of everybody. And then one day you get in the room and you're like, oh, I'm actually meeting the real person now, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Well, okay, you know, and that actually segues pretty easily into the second thing I was going to say earlier, which is maybe take like a personality test. Understandingmyself.com is a big 5 personality test. That's great, because what you're going to find is whatever spectrums you guys are on the other ends of, like opposite ends of the spectrum on personality, that's going to be your locus of conflict. And those are going to be the conflicts that you're never going to necessarily resolve completely, because they're not embedded in just some disagreement over something superficial. It's like core parts of your personality. One of you wants to hang out with people 5 times a week. One of you finds that completely depleting and awful and terrible and doesn't want to go to group things, would just rather snuggle up and watch TV. Or, you know, so those aren't problems that are going to go away if someone just talks the other person into it. And so you have to know what those are and then build reasonable skill sets around those personality dynamics that you guys are going to conflict on. And so understandingmyself.com is a personality test that really breaks that down. And then having conversations like, okay, you're an introvert, I'm an extrovert, or you're really high in openness and really creative, and I'm really high in conscientiousness, I'm really by the book. Let's have conversations around how to have communication and not moralize the other person's personality. Because that's what happens, is the other person's like, well, you're just lazy and all over the place and undependable, when really they're not. They're just creative, kind of free spirit. Or you're just a killjoy and you just suck and never want to have fun. It's like, well, no, they want to have security before they feel like they can have fun. They don't want to overspend on the budget. And so we moralize those things. So having a good understanding of personality, having a good understanding of how that's going to affect your relationship. Budget, like figure out money. You can read a book called Come As You Are, which is a book on female sexuality and the female arousal system. Gosh, just some basic psychoeducation around how women engage sexually is helpful for a lot of Christian men who had none of those conversations and no conversations in church, that female sexual arousal systems are different than men's. And if you try to organize your entire sex life around what turns just you on, or what, you know, is just enjoyable for you, you're going to really create a lot of distance and you're going to make your wife feel really unseen. So that's another one. I could keep going.
Since you mentioned sexuality, I'm so curious, because this is something I get from a lot of people who are not Christian, and actually I guess Christian too, but there's the whole idea that Christianity, even though philosophically I would argue it does not, anyone who reads Song of Psalms recognizes that it definitely endorses healthy sexuality, and that's a gift from God. But it seems that, like, culturally, Christianity is viewed as the ultimate buzzkill and suppression of the sexual instinct. Mm-hmm. And that, do you find a lot of people, when they finally get married and have trouble adjusting from this has been taboo for so long, and now suddenly it's okay, and, you know, they have trouble sort of crossing that chasm and now being like, oh, it's okay to, you know, sexual from a Christian standpoint?
I wouldn't say that I find that with Christians broadly, but I think that some people that have a very specific experience within the Christian church around interpreting purity culture conversations and converting those into strict and rigid rules that they internalize really deeply. And maybe that's coupled with a sense of either self-shame or complicated by an abuse background, or maybe just they have a personality that's kind of neurotic and very sensitive to the kind of sexual rules and taboos. It's complex. I think that that's not necessarily something I think is indicative of a Christian experience.
Yeah. All right. Well, last question, since we're coming up in time here, I have to ask this because it's all the rage, but personality test, Enneagram, Strength Finder, Myers-Briggs, flipping a coin. What is the best way to know yourself based on those tests? Any favorites that you
big
like?
Big five. Yeah, big five. Big five personality test. That's understandingmyself.com. That's my favorite one.
It's your favorite one. Okay.
Yeah, I think the reason I like it is because it's been cross-culturally verified too. You can do that test on someone who lives in Indonesia, someone who lives in America, and they're gonna have similar personality spectrums. It's not a culturally confined test. You can even do that on different generations and get really results that are really close to the actual person. So you could do that test on Abraham Lincoln. You could do it on me. And it's not going to ebb and flow and shift depending on the cultural milieu, so to speak. It's one of the few personality tests. Myers-Briggs is like that too, but few personality tests that I think carries across culture. So like Enneagram, for example, that's great for middle-class white folks in America. That's awesome. But I haven't seen him be like super relevant and like these aha moments of self-discovery for people in other cultures. Not saying it's not. I'm sure people of other cultures have enjoyed that too, but that's my take.
Well, I owe you a thank you because I was looking for an angry mob, and since you've now denigrated the Enneagram, I can assure you that the mob, the Jonathan Edwards fans and the Enneagrammers and the convergence of those two are going to be now liking and undisliking and unfollowing me. So
Funny. Yep. I think I pissed off the Calvinists and the...
you did it, man. You were the most ecumenical offender I think we've ever found.
Well,
you
thanks.
Know?
I try to... Yeah, you know, equal opportunity for all, you know.
That's great. Well, Matthias, thank you so much. We're just going to have you come back because we just touched the surface of marriage and relationships and so much there. And it's so helpful. I love your mind, man. And I love what you read. I love that you read such deep things that require so much attention since I'm not able to. And then you can distill them down for me so I don't have to. So I can keep reading Curious George while you read John Wesley. So thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate it. And I hope you'll come back and see us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Kinda Christian. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a 5-star review.